Okay, pay attention to me now. Let's talk a little bit about DNA, which is the theme of today. One of the most famous molecules in the world nowadays. Whether it's for forensic reasons or not, it's famous in forensics because it's a good way of identifying people, right? What is DNA, though? Chemically speaking. Well, okay, what does it stand for? Right, deoxyribonucleic acid, which tells you what it is. It's a nucleic acid, which is one of the four kinds of biological macromolecules. RNA is also a nucleic acid. But DNA is a polymer as well. Three of those kinds of macromolecules that organisms use are polymers, which means they are built by hooking together a bunch of subunits. Those three polymers are proteins, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides. And so a DNA molecule is not only a polymer, it's an extraordinarily large polymer because there are millions of subunits that are put together to build one molecule. What are those subunits called, by the way? Well, those are their individual names, but they are all examples of what? What is the name for the general name for the subunit or the monomer of DNA? They're called nucleotides. So adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, the A, T, C, and G letters, those are nitrogenous bases of nucleotides. Every nucleotide has three components to it, one of which is a nitrogenous base. That's what makes nucleotides different from each other. Otherwise, all nucleotides, the other two parts of nucleotides are the same. So anyway, when you string together millions of those in some order, you have a DNA molecule. And it's that order that allows us to be able to distinguish DNA from one source versus DNA from some other source. All right? One thing that we're studying today is the ability to cut DNA into smaller chunks and tell the difference between individuals based on the size of those chunks that the DNA gets broken into. And the reason this works is that we use a tool to cut at specific places, and those specific places that get where the DNA gets cut, it's called restriction sites, because the tools we use to cut them are called restriction enzymes. They're also called restriction endonucleases. Enzyme names end in A-S-E usually. That's how you know something is an enzyme. A nuclease is an enzyme whose job it is to cut a nucleic acid. All right? An endonuclease cuts a nucleic acid by making a cut somewhere in the middle, endo, rather than just cutting one subunit off the end. So these restriction endonucleases are enzymes that occur naturally, were discovered where they occur naturally, which is in bacteria. Bacteria evolved restriction endonucleases as a way to defend themselves against viral attack. A virus attacks a bacterium by injecting its own DNA into the bacterium and fooling the bacterial cell into thinking that DNA is the bacterium's own DNA, and therefore it makes copies of it, and then it uses the instructions in the DNA to build proteins. Well, a new virus is really, a virus itself is really nothing but DNA wrapped in protein. So if you fool the bacterium into making DNA and protein, you have the components you need to make brand new viruses. And so a virus that invades a bacterium fools it into making a bunch of copies of that virus. Eventually, the bacterium explodes and just releases a bunch of new viruses. That's how viruses, they can't reproduce on their own, but that's how they get to be reproduced. Well, this is obviously bad for the bacterium. It kills it. A bacterium is a unicellular organism. When you lose the one cell that you are, that's bad news, right? So they evolved a mechanism to protect themselves against this, which is the restriction enzymes that they make. And there are many different restriction enzymes. But restriction enzymes are enzymes that recognize a very specific and very short sequence of nucleotides within this long stretch of DNA nucleotides on the entire molecule. And if it sees the right sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, just, you know, usually about six nucleotides long, if it's the right sequence, then that particular enzyme will cut the DNA into two pieces at that restriction site, as it's called. The places where these restriction enzymes work are called palindromes. Do you know the word palindrome? What is a palindrome? Right, it's something that read forward is the same as what it is read backward. Like a Toyota, right? Same backwards as forward. Or a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Reading that backwards, it's the same thing. That is a palindrome. Well, the restriction sites that these enzymes recognize are also called palindromes. In DNA, we have a whole long sequence of C's, T's, A's, and G's. So if we have a sequence like this, let me do this. If that's the sequence on one of the two strands of DNA, the other strand has to be complementary to that, meaning that if there's a C there, it has to be a G. If there's a T, it has to be an A. So G is going to be C here, A is going to be T, this is going to be C, it's going to be G, A, and G. Notice that what one of the strands reads in one direction, the other one reads the same in the reverse direction. That's why it's a palindrome, genetically. And these palindromic sites are what these restriction enzymes recognize. Each different restriction enzyme produced by a different kind of bacterium will recognize its own palindrome. If it doesn't see the palindrome, the enzyme will do nothing to the DNA. But if that palindrome is there somewhere in the sequence, every time it's there in the overall sequence, it will be cut at that position. So different DNA will be cut into different numbers and sizes of pieces by a given restriction enzyme, right? If you have identical DNA in two samples, they're going to have those restriction sites at exactly the same place, and therefore the same enzyme will cut those two identical pieces of DNA into the same number and size of pieces. Does that make sense? But if they're from different individuals, those restriction sites will appear at different positions, and therefore the same restriction enzyme cutting both samples will cut them into a different number and different size chunks. And that's how we can, as long as we can have a way to recognize how big the chunks are, which we do, and I'll mention that later, then we've shown that they're actually different DNA. And so that's why it's forensically used. That's one of the reasons it's forensically useful. Okay? But all of this requires having enough DNA to work with. And, you know, criminals aren't notorious for ensuring that they leave plenty of DNA to work with, right? They're trying not to do that. So often, if you have a DNA sample at all, it's very little DNA. And to work with DNA, you need, in the various methods that we'll talk about later, you actually have to have enough in order to do those procedures. And so that brings up the second important part of today, which is the PCR. An acronym, of course, but what does that stand for? The polymerase chain reaction, exactly. Notice that polymerase also ends in ASE, so that's another enzyme. In naturally occurring cells, like your own cells, when a cell is about to split into two new cells, which is happening all the time in your body, it's important for those two new cells each to have their own DNA, right? A full library of DNA. So when one cell becomes two cells, in preparation for that, it first has to replicate its DNA, make an exact copy enough for two cells so that when it splits into two cells, each one will have a full complement of DNA. And doing that copying process involves an enzyme called polymerase. The polymerase chain reaction is really just a technique that we do to mimic what happens naturally in cells in order to double the amount of DNA, because it, in DNA replication that occurs in our cells, we're doubling the amount of DNA, right? The one cell's DNA becomes enough for two. Well, if we do this, if we mimic this process just in test tubes, but do it more than once, we do it over and over, every time we do the process, every time through the cycle, we double the amount of DNA that the previous cycle gave us. So we go through it once, we doubled the amount of DNA, we go through it again, now we've quadrupled it. Do it again, now we have 8 times as much, 16 times as much, and if you keep doubling that, usually about 40 times, you end up with a hell of a lot, because 2 to the 40th power is a big number.
No matter how often you duplicate it, it'll always come out exactly the same.
Right, because the polymerase molecule reads the existing DNA, and because of the rules of complementarity, which means if there's a C here, the other, you have to have a G here. If there's a T here, you have to have an A here. By reading the original code, it knows exactly what to make the complement of. And so you end up making 2 copies of what was 1 originally, each iteration. So the PCR process is a chain reaction because it's doubled each time. Okay, process that occurs in cycles. Each iteration of the cycle doubles the amount of DNA, but each iteration of the cycle, I'm not going to get into that. Let's just keep it at each iteration of the cycle doubles the amount of DNA. PCR is used, it's a basic tool now in biotechnology. It's not just for forensic reasons that you need to have a lot of DNA, a lot of copies of the DNA you're working with. Anytime you need to amplify the amount of DNA that you have in a sample, for whatever reason, forensic or not, PCR is the way to go. Now, this was originally done laboriously in test tubes by hand, but now it has gotten to the point where just this little machine fully automatically goes through all the iterations, all 40 cycles. All you have to do is load it, program it, leave it for a few hours, come back later, and you have millions of copies of whatever original DNA you have. All right? But you need the building blocks to do that. And what do you need to build DNA? I already told you the answer. It's the stuff that DNA is built out of, which is nucleotides, exactly. So in the mix, that master mix that you're using, are billions of individual nucleotides of all 4 types, A's, C's, T's, and G's, so that when they are needed, as the code is being read and you need it, an A, it's there in the solution. You have the enzyme to read the code and build the new one, and you have the raw materials in the form of nucleotides. But you also have primers. Okay, so in the PCR process, you actually don't make a copy of the full sample of DNA that you have. Instead, in PCR, you need to know what you're looking for. So you have some sample of DNA, it's a long stretch of nucleotides, but you really only want to amplify some subset within that sample that has a specific beginning sequence and a specific ending sequence. The primers that are part of this mix are little pieces of DNA with the correct sequence to look for a complementary sequence in your sample. All right, so we have a sample which is very long sequence, double-stranded DNA, A's, T's, C's, and G's in some order all the way along there. But we really care about a little sequence there and a little sequence there, all the DNA between those two points. Okay? In order to recognize this beginning and this beginning, we need a little piece of DNA that's complementary to whatever those A's, T's, C's, and G's are there so that it can recognize it. And when it does, then this one is going to be copied this way and this one's going to be copied this way, and you end up making a replicate or a copy of just this section of the DNA, not the whole sample. Okay? Well, if your sample doesn't have that little sequence that the primers are looking for, then it won't make anything. Okay? It'll only amplify exactly the type of DNA that you want if it's there. So PCR not only amplifies DNA, it also is a way of telling you whether your specific sample contains a specific type of DNA. Okay? So that's the process. And your work today is to follow the instructions as carefully as possible to do a good job on this. You're going to extract your own DNA, right? Where do you get it from? Yeah, you're going to spit in cups, but don't it just... The cells are not really so much in your saliva. The cells come from your cheeks. Your cheeks are continuously being abraded and losing millions of cells just like your skin every day. And so the longer you swish that saline solution in your mouth over and get it all over your mouth for, you know, like 30 seconds at least, the better chances you have of putting cells into that liquid you're going to spit into the cup. Only if you have cells from your cheeks are you going to get any DNA, because the DNA is in the cells. All right. So swish for a long time and you won't have to redo it. But that's the purpose of using the saline solution. You're actually extracting cells that are falling off of you inside of your cheeks. Another thing I want to make sure you're careful about is the materials, how they're labeled. Pay attention to the materials box in your protocol, the printout. For instance, notice that the chelating agent is labeled as IgM, which might not make sense. IgM actually stands for Instagene Matrix. It's a brand name. But it is the chelating agent. So when the protocol refers to the tube containing the chelating agent, it's the one labeled as IgM. Chelating agent is important, by the way, because what it does is take cations, positively charged ions, out of solution, which is important because cations are important to make certain enzymes that are in your own cells that could break down the DNA. It keeps them inactivated. You don't want to break down your DNA, so you want to inactivate the enzymes in your own cells that could break down the DNA once it's exposed. You want it to be an intact piece so that when you then subject it to the restriction enzyme from the bacterium, it will cut it only when you want it to cut it. Okay? That's the purpose of the IgM. But label everything well. Make sure you're using the right volumes and make sure you're properly using micropipetters when you do this, especially because these are very small volumes that we have. It's enough for you if you're using proper micropipetting technique. But if you push it all the way down to suck up, you're going to be taking too much, and you're going to have some group not have enough that way. Okay, so only down to the soft stop when you're drawing up. I think that's it. Make sure. Oh, no, one more thing. There's two different sizes of tubes. Don't touch any of the tubes before you put gloves on, especially the ones that are in the little bag. These little bags, and it's labeled as PCR tubes, but don't confuse centrifuge tubes with PCR tubes. The PCR tubes are much smaller, and these are the ones that actually have to go into this machine. By the way, this machine for PCR is called a thermal cycler. And these very small ones are the ones that go into here, not the 1.5 milliliter centrifuge tubes, which are these ones. Okay? The trick here is that you need to have all of your tubes, 8 tubes I think it is, each group gives me, labeled. Those PCR tubes are tiny, but you need to label each one. You need to label it 1 through 8 or whatever the numbers are. Plus, on the lid, you need to make some identifier of your group that's different from all the others. So think of a way to label the top with a Sharpie. No, can't put any tape on these because then they won't go into the machine. Plus, the machine gets hot and cold and hot and cold. You can't do that. So put gloves on before you handle them, but carefully mark on them with a Sharpie. You also cannot put these small PCR tubes into your centrifuge. If you need to centrifuge the PCRs, they first go into a spinning tube, which is just like one of the 1.7 milliliter centrifuge tubes, but it's just a way of holding the tube itself so that you can get it out of the centrifuge otherwise. Put it directly into the centrifuge, you're not going to be able to get it out. Okay? All right, I've said enough probably. Go ahead and start, and be careful.